This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
This podcast is supported by The RealReal.
You know what I love most about the holidays? Giving gifts. But not just any gifts. Real gifts. Thoughtful gifts. Oh my God, how did you know gifts? That's why I love gift shopping with The RealReal. The RealReal is the most trusted name in authenticated luxury resale. And it's a holiday shopping secret I'm going to let you in on. Whether it's a surprisingly affordable, pristine condition bag for your BFF, a vintage find that's cool enough for the Gen Zer in your life, or even something your impossible to shop for dad will love. Get used to saying, I found it on The RealReal. Seriously, with over 10,000 new arrivals dropping every day from brands like Gucci, Fendi, Prada, Louis Vuitton, Tiffany & Co., and Cartier, there's guaranteed to be something for everyone on your list. Oh, and did I mention everything's up to 90% off retail?
Get $25 off your first purchase at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com to get your $25 off. TheRealReal.com.
When we look at the war in Ukraine, what do we see? Usually we see a map, we see red and blue zones, we see arrows indicating tank movements in the Donbas. We see the daily updates of kilometers gained or lost. We obsess over the hardware, the F-16s, the Abrams tanks, the drone strikes. And that makes sense. In a war for survival, the front line is the most immediate reality. But today, I want to suggest that this map is lying to you. Or at the very least, it's only telling you 10% of the story. Because while the armies are fighting in the trenches, there are other wars being fought in the shadows. Wars that are arguably more dangerous for the future of Europe than the artillery duels we see on the news.
You're listening to Nelson John 360.
Nelson John 360.
Hey guys, welcome to Nelson John 360, and I'm your host, Nelson John. The news is wide, but rarely deep. I'm here to fix that. Today, we're taking a single topic, the future of the Ukraine war. And we are looking at it through the lens of strategists, sociologists, and historians. We're going to uncover five uncomfortable truths that usually get buried under the daily headlines. We're going to talk about why, for the Kremlin, peace is just a trap. We're going to discuss the invisible mental health crisis that threatens to break the nation from the inside. We'll look at a terrifying hypothetical American peace plan, and we'll ask the hardest questions of all. What happens if Ukraine wins the war but loses the peace? This is not the story of the battlefield. This is the story of the brutal logic of survival. Let's dive in. Now, let's start with the concept of peace. In the West, when we hear the word peace negotiations, we think of a compromise. We think of stopping the bloodshed. We imagine diplomats in Geneva or Istanbul finding a middle ground. But to understand what is happening now, we have to understand how the Kremlin views that word. There is a quote from Vladislav Surkov. For years, Surkov was known as the Grey Cardinal of the Kremlin. He was Putin's puppet master, the architect of modern Russian political strategy. And he once said something that chills the blood if you really think about it. He said, quote unquote, "Peace is nothing more than the continuation of war by other means." Now, take a second to absorb that. For the Russian strategic mindset, peace isn't the end of the conflict. It simply is a different phase of the conflict. It is a tool. When you can't win with tanks, you use treaties. When you can't win with artillery, you use diplomacy to buy time, to confuse your enemy, and to rot their resolve from the inside. We don't have to guess if this is true. We have a historical case study. The Minsk Second Agreement of 2015. If you remember back in 2014 and 2015, the war in the Donbas was raging. The West was desperate to freeze the conflict. So they pushed for the Minsk agreements. On paper, it looked like a path to peace. But analysts at the Institute for the Study of War, and frankly, anyone watching closely, saw it differently. The agreement was fundamentally flawed. Why? Because it treated the war as an internal conflict. It absolved Russia of responsibility. It forced Ukraine to negotiate with puppets controlled by Moscow. It gave Vladimir Putin a massive strategic win. It allowed him to control Ukraine's politics without needing a full-scale invasion. It was a leash. And because the world accepted that peace, because we failed to push the aggressor then, we laid the direct groundwork for the full-scale invasion of 2022. So here is the first uncomfortable truth we have to confront today. When we hear rumors of ceasefires or freezing the lines, we have to ask, is this an off-ramp or is it a trap? If we look at history, what looks like de-escalation to us looks like an opportunity to reload the Kremlin. They're not looking for a settlement. They are looking for a pause button so they can press play again when we aren't looking. Now, I want to move away from the geopolitics for a moment and look at the human reality. Because wars are not fought by maps. They're fought by people. And the deepest wounds in this war are not the craters in the streets of Kharkiv or the ruins of Bakhmut. The deepest wounds are invisible. There was a devastating report released recently by the Chatham House. They looked at the sociological impact of this invasion, and the numbers are staggering. The data suggests that 80% of the Ukrainian population is experiencing mental health impacts. I'm talking about anxiety, depression, PTSD. The World Health Organization estimates that between 10 to 15 million Ukrainians will need specialist psychological help. Think about that number. 15 million people. Now, that's roughly the population of, let's say, the Netherlands. This is an entire nation within a nation walking around with deep, unresolved trauma. And this leads us to a very specific, very dangerous problem: the veterans. Ukraine currently has hundreds of thousands of men and women in uniform. They've been living in trenches, under constant drone surveillance, seeing their friends die for years. One day, hopefully soon, the guns will stop, and those hundreds of thousands of soldiers will go home. Now, reintegrating combat veterans is hard for any country. Look at the struggles the US faced after Vietnam or Iraq. But for Ukraine, the scale is massive. The Chatham House report draws a parallel that we really need to pay attention to. They pointed to the Afghanistan. Now, what's Afghanistan? The Afghanistis were the Soviet veterans of the war in Afghanistan in the 1980s. When they came back to the USSR, the state was collapsing. There were no jobs. There were no physical support. They were ignored. So what happened? Many of them took their skills, organization, violence, loyalty, and were absorbed into the criminal underworld. They became the muscle for the rise of organized crime in the 90s. Now, you see, this is a ticking clock that Ukraine is facing. If the state cannot support these veterans, they feel abandoned. They could become a destabilizing force. They could become a threat to the very social stability they fought to protect. This isn't about whether Ukraine wins the military war. This is about whether Ukrainian society can survive the peace. This brings us to our third point, and this one is perhaps the most ironic. Ukraine's greatest challenge after the war might not be Russia. It might be itself. Let's imagine a best-case scenario. Let's imagine Ukraine pushes Russia back, secures its borders, and the war ends. What happens the next morning? The unity that comes from facing a common enemy evaporates. And suddenly, Ukraine has to face the demons that were there before 2022. We're talking about Sistema. In Ukraine, Sistema is the word used to describe the deep-rooted crony capitalism that has plagued the country since the fall of the Soviet Union. It's the network of oligarchs, corrupt officials, and backroom deals that has historically held the economy back. Right now, that system is suppressed by martial law and the urgency of war. But when the war ends, the old habits will try to return. And here is where the politics gets fascinating. President Volodymyr Zelensky is a global hero. We see him in the green t-shirt rallying the world. But reports suggest that internally, he is worried about the Churchill effect. Winston Churchill led Britain to victory in World War II. He was a giant, and yet weeks after the war ended in Europe, the British public voted him out of office. Why? Because he was a war leader, and they wanted a peace leader. They wanted someone to rebuild the economy, not fight battles. Zelensky knows this. He knows that the second the fighting stops, the question begins. Why was the South lost so quickly? Why was there corruption in the procurement ministry? And there is a social divide opening up too. The war has created two different Ukraines. There are the people who stayed, who lived through the air raid sirens, the shortages, the fear. And then there are the millions who fled to Poland, Germany, the UK or Canada. When those refugees return, well, if they return, there's going to be friction. Where were you when Kyiv was under attack? Why should you get a say in the new government when you were safe in Berlin? These are ugly questions, but they're real. So when we talk about a victory, we have to realize that for Ukraine, victory on the battlefield is just the starting gun for a brutal internal battle for reform, unity, and identity. Now let's zoom out. Let's look at the geopolitics of 2025. Because while Ukraine is fighting for itself, the world powers are drafting plans for its future. And some of those plans are alarming. There has been a lot of analysis recently from the Financial Times, from the Medusa, from the Guardian, outlining a hypothetical peace plan that might emerge from Washington, specifically if there is a change in administration. Let's call this the realpolitik scenario. It's a 28-point plan, and when officials in Kyiv read the details of these hypothetical proposals, they don't see a peace plan deal here. They see an ultimatum. Let me break down what this plan allegedly looks like. If you're sitting down, you might want to brace yourself. Point one, Ukraine would have to surrender the remainder of the eastern Donbas region. Not just what Russia holds now, but the whole territory. Point two, Ukraine would have to formally recognize Russian sovereignty over Crimea and the Donbas. Now, the US wouldn't necessarily recognize it, but they would force Kyiv to sign a piece of paper saying, this is yours. Point three, a freeze of the current front lines in the south, Zaporizhzhia and Kherson. Point four, and this is the kicker, Ukraine would be required to reduce the size of its military by half. Point five, granting the Russian language official status within Ukraine. Now, when you hear that list, what does it sound like to you? To many analysts, it sounds like Russia's maximalist demands. It sounds like the thing Putin asked for at the very beginning. Let me tell you, it's shocking, because it imagines a scenario where the United States, Ukraine's biggest ally, essentially adopts the aggressor's wish list. Why? Why would Washington propose something so heavily tilted towards Russia? The argument is fatigue. The argument is that the war is unwinnable, that it is a stalemate, and that the risk of escalation is too high. The realists in Washington, and there are many of them, believe that sacrificing Ukrainian territory is a price worth paying to stabilize relations with Moscow and pivot to China. For Kyiv, this is the nightmare scenario. It is a feeling of being sold out. But here's the most terrifying part. Even if this deal is terrible, Ukraine might not be able to say no. Now that brings us to our final point. The logic of yes, but. Now this is the strategic trap. Let's say it's late 2025, which we are already in. The US administration puts this 28-point plan on the table. It demands Ukraine to give up land, shrink its army, and swallow its pride. The gut reaction of any Ukrainian patriot would be to tear that paper up, to say we will never surrender. But analysts at Responsible Statecraft have pointed out a brutal reality. They argue that in this scenario, Ukraine would be, and I quote, insane to reject this plan outright. Why? Because of the leverage. If a US president presents a peace plan and Zelensky rejects it, the narrative shifts instantly. Suddenly, Ukraine is no longer the defender. It's the eyes of the White House. Ukraine becomes the obstacle to peace. And the threat is implicit but clear. If you don't sign this, the aid stops. No military shells, no more Patriot missiles, no more intelligence sharing. Now, without US aid, Ukraine's ability to hold the current line collapses. We aren't talking about a stalemate anymore. We're talking about a potential Russian breakthrough. We're talking about Russian tanks rolling towards the Dnieper River. So the choice Kyiv faces is not peace deal versus victory. The choice is unjust peace deal versus total collapse. It is the ultimate rock and a hard place. It is a terrifying logic where survival itself depends on accepting a humiliation. It reminds us that in international relations, there is no such thing as fair. There is only power. And right now, Ukraine's survival is entirely dependent on the power of its allies. And if those allies decide the war is over, well, you guessed right, the war is over. So where does this leave us? We started by looking at the map, but we've ended up somewhere much more complex. We realize now that peace is a weapon used by the Kremlin. We realize that the wounds are psychological, affecting 15 million people. We see the enemy within, the struggle for reform and unity, and we see the diplomatic trap, the pressure to accept an unjust deal to avoid annihilation. The war in Ukraine is teaching us a harsh lesson about the 21st century. It's teaching us that the lines between victory and survival are blurred. And as we watch the news in the coming months, keep these 5 points in mind. When you hear about a new diplomatic summit, ask yourself, is this a trap? When you hear about a breakthrough on the front, ask yourself, how is the society holding up behind the lines? And perhaps the most haunting question of all is the one we leave you with today. When peace can be a weapon and survival requires unthinkable compromise, what does a just end to do this war actually look like? Does it even exist? You've been listening to Nelson John 360. I'm your host, Nelson John. If you found value in this deep dive, if you want to understand the machinery of the world and not just the headlines, do me a favor. Hit that subscribe button. Share this episode with one friend who needs to know what really is going on. I'll be back soon, taking one topic and examining it from every angle. In the meanwhile, you can probably look me up on Instagram. Nelson John 360. Yes, that it is. Until then, keep looking past the map. Stay safe, stay smart.